So today I wanted to talk about quantum key distribution. Which is almost always abbreviated QKD. And in particular, I'm going to talk about the BB84 protocol, at least mostly. So remember last week when we were talking about factoring in RSA, I mentioned that there were these two kinds of encryption protocols. One is a private key protocol and one is a public key protocol. So in a private key protocol, you have Alice and Bob. And again, remember the general setup of cryptography is that there's an eavesdropper, Eve. And Alice wants to send a secret message to Bob, and they share some private key. Which Eve does not know. And then that key is used for both encryption and decryption. And then Eve, not having a secret key, will not be able to read the message. So certainly the most widely used private key encryption protocols have only computational security. But there's one that has information theoretic security, which is called the one-time pad. And there's variants of it too, basically. So in the one-time pad, the private key is a random bit string. Of n bits. And we're going to send an n bit message. And this is the kind of the key thing that makes the protocol information theoretically secure, is that the random bit string is as long as the message. I mean, it could be longer, of course, but it has to be at least as long. And the ciphertext, so the encryption protocol, is very straightforward. It's just E, which is M plus K, bitwise XOR. Okay, so whenever the key bit in a given position is zero, the ciphertext is actually the same as the corresponding message bit. But when the key bit is one, the ciphertext is the opposite. And what that means is that, well, let me just mention the decryption. So if Bob wants to decrypt this, he can very easily do that, because you can get M back by taking E plus K. Right, do the bitwise XOR again. But if Eve doesn't know K and she just sees the ciphertext, well, each bit that she sees is equally likely to be 0 or 1, right? No matter what the message was. Okay, and so the point is that all she sees is a string of random bits. And in fact, since K is itself uniformly random, every message from her point of view is equally likely, right? Any message had exactly the same probability of seeing this particular ciphertext. And so what that means is she has no information about the message. Even if she already knew a lot about the message, she doesn't gain any more information. And that's why this is an information theoretically secure protocol. But you see, there's a big drawback, which is that you have this random bit string that's as long as the message. And if you're sending very long messages, that's a lot of bits. Moreover, you can only use it once. That's why it's the one-time pad. Because if you use it twice, well, you can think of that as like two messages. You think of the two messages being sent by this thing as one much longer message. And if you're using the same key twice, then you know the key is no longer as long as the message. And in fact, if you use the same key twice, and you take the XOR of two to ciphertext, and then you'll get the XOR of the messages. And actually, historically, there was a case during the Cold War where the Soviet Union accidentally used their code books had pages that were printed twice, and so they used the same keys twice. And the US used that to actually break, the NSA used that to break a bunch of these supposedly one-time pads. So it is not just a theoretical issue, but it's an actual practical one.
What if the RNG is cheating?
Yeah, so that's the other thing, is that these have to be truly random in order to be information theoretically secure. If it's just some pseudo-random number generator, then it's only computationally secure, because you're saying, well, I don't have enough computational power to break down this random number generator and figure out what the random numbers would be.
How about these people that want to use quantum, say, filters or whatever, to just use a create random numbers? Is that a really pedestrian use of quantum?
Right, okay. So, So there's a lot to be said about quantum mechanics for random number generators. The easiest way is just, you know, you take a photon, you put it through a beam splitter, 50-50, it's on one side or the other, and that's your random number. And there you believe that the randomness is kind of truly coming from quantum mechanics, and it is fundamentally random. If you really want to be sure about that, you have to be sure that, you know, the beam splitter is really 50-50 and not 49-51. That creates a slight bias, and this is no longer totally random anymore, and stuff like that. But as a first approximation, it's certainly good. Now, there's a lot that can be said about processing numbers to kind of try to make them more random. And they're related to QKD, there are some tricks that let you do that even better in quantum mechanics. I probably will not have time to talk about that. In practice, I think people generate these random bit strings in a lot of different ways. They usually use some kind of physical source of randomness if they really want it to be random. Whether that's kind of truly, truly random or not, it can be a bit of a subjective issue. But, you know, if you're using bits of the microwave background radiation or some quantum, you know, beam splitter or Brownian motion or something like that, these are all the types of things that people will talk about doing. Okay, so anyway, so if you want to use the one-time cat pad in practice, that means that Alice and Bob have had to get together in the past or send, you know, a trusted courier with this one-time pad to establish between them. And if they weren't careful enough about that and Eve managed to get information about the key, then it's not secure. And moreover, they can only do it for so long, and then they're going to run out of key, right? If the messages that they send use up all their key, then they have to do it again. Okay, so that's a drawback of the one-time pad. The advantage, well, the two advantages, one is it's information theoretically secure. The other is that it's really very, very quick and easy to use once you have the key. So the advantage of the public key system, remember, in contrast to the private key system, is that distributing the key was much easier. You could publish it, you could give it to all your friends and ask them to give it to other people and so on and so forth, right? You didn't have to be careful about what happened to your public key. So quantum key distribution is an attempt using quantum mechanics to basically make it easier to distribute private keys. And then you can use those private keys for the one-time pad. Or you could use them for a variety of other things. Private keys are useful for a lot of cryptographic protocols, including computationally secure protocols. Those still need a private key. It just can be shorter and be used more often. So how does it work? This is called the BB84 protocol, because it was invented by Bennett and Broussard in roughly 1984. It was actually a little bit before, but it appeared in some conference in 1984, I think. So the basic idea is Alice is going to be sending to Bob, and Alice is going to send qubits to Bob. say single photons. And then Bob is going to make some measurements, and they'll do some classical discussion back and forth about the states that Alice sent and the things that Bob received, and then decide, do they have a secure key or not? So let's go through those steps. So first, Alice has to generate a bunch of random numbers, right? We're going to need random numbers in here somewhere. So how does she do that? Well, she starts out with some pairs of bits. And so this big N is going to be bigger than the final number of bits of key they get at the end. We're going to use up some of this. So she has two bits in each of these pairs. Let's see. So each pair specifies a state of a qubit. So Alice creates those qubits and sends them to Bob. Okay, I'm just realizing that I'm not gonna have enough space here. Okay. Anyway, so what's the mapping? So AI specifies the basis. And RI specifies the state in the basis. So the basis is either the X basis or the Z basis. And then the RI is going to be basically 0 or 1 in that basis. So specifically, if AI is 0, then we have a state 0 or 1, Z basis. And if AI is 1, we have a state plus or minus. OK? So Alice sends these to Bob, and then Bob is going to measure them. But what basis is going to measure them? He doesn't know yet what basis Alice sent, right? He knows that each qubit could be an X basis or could be a Z basis, but it's equally likely to be either. So what he's going to do is he's just going to choose n random bases. Which is again bits bi, and measures qubit I in basis bi. Okay, so so if he picks the random bit 0, he'll measure in the Z basis. And if he picks the random bit one, he'll measure in the X basis. So notice that if Alice sent in the Z basis and Bob measured in the Z basis, then he'll get, in the absence of errors, he'll get the thing that Alice sent. Whereas if Alice sent in, say, the X basis and Bob measured in the Z basis, then he'll get something random. Okay. So what we want to do is, at this point, Alice and Bob will both announce their bases. So I guess maybe I should be a little more clear here. So the model that we have is that Alice and Bob have a quantum channel between them, and that's insecure. Because Eve can can interact with it. And that means not just reading it, but also changing it, which in the quantum case are kind of the same. And they also have some classical channels, which are public. So Eve can read them as well. OK. So anyway, so in particular, they announce AI and BI. Sorry, let's see. Basis BI getting result SI. So they're announcing AI and BI, but they're not announcing RI and SI. Right, they have to keep something secret from Eve. So if AI equals BI, keep bit I. And if AI is not equal to BI, discard bit I. Okay, so this is resolving the problem that Bob doesn't know what basis Alice sent. He measures in a random basis. If it's the same basis, they keep it. And if it's the opposite basis, they throw it away. So the point is that at this point, again, in the absence of errors, so in the absence of errors, then they should have this should have the same bits for the leftover values RI and SI. Okay, does everyone see that? Okay, now of course in the real world there will be some errors, so they won't be exactly the same. So they're gonna have to deal with that. But more importantly, remember the eavesdropper could be listening and she could be doing stuff, right? So what might she do to try to attack this protocol? Well, the obvious thing is she could take this qubit that Alice sends, capture it, do a measurement, and then send something on to Bob. Okay. So let's think about one example of that. So suppose Alice sends a qubit and Bob and Eve decides to guess and measure. And measure it, but she, remember, doesn't know what basis it's in, right? So if she guesses right, so if Alice sends one of these states and she measures in the Z basis, well, then she'll find out what that bit is. And then she can make another copy of that bit and send it on to Bob. But suppose she guesses wrong and measures in the X basis instead of the Z basis, right? Well, now she's going to get a random result. And if she tries to send the state on to Bob, well, she could send the state that she got. That makes sense, right? But then if Bob happens to measure in the Z basis, so let's take this as an example. So suppose Alice sends 0. Eve measures X and gets, say, plus. And then Bob measures Z. Okay? This is just an example, of course. So what happens? Well, Eve sent on this plus state. That was, you know, what she got. So it's the best information she has about what the state is. And Bob measures Z. So he has an equally likely chance of getting 0 or 1. So there's a 50% chance in this particular case that Bob get 0, which is correct, but there's also a 50% chance that Bob gets 1. And that's not right. Okay? So even if there's no errors from, you know, the normal stuff that's going on because of imperfections in the system, the presence of an eavesdropper who's actively doing something to the qubits to try to learn about them will introduce errors. Okay. You can show that anything that Eve might attempt to do that could gain her information about the key or about the bits RI and SI is going to introduce errors. Okay? That's just a basic fact of quantum mechanics, that you can't make a measurement without changing the state. Okay? Information gain implies disturbance. Okay, and that's really the key conceptual idea of QKD, that if there's an eavesdropper, she can't learn anything without revealing her presence by creating errors. So okay, so how are we going to detect this? So Alice and Bob will, in the next step, choose a random subset of bits. Say 50%, doesn't have to be, but some fraction. And for that subset, they're going to actually announce RI and SI. So obviously, the ones they announced are no longer secret. But because they've announced them, they can compare. And they calculate an error rate. And so if the error rate is too high, they abort. Otherwise, they continue.
The bits that they choose from are the bits that they disagree on the basis for.
No, that they agreed on the basis for. See, they've already thrown away. It's the remaining bits, right? They've already thrown away half, and now they're using another half to try to figure out what the error rate is. Okay. So let's see. So so Eve then has a trade-off that she wants to do. So first of all, they could just say if there's any errors at all, they'll throw it out. That would be, in some sense, the safest thing to do. The problem is that if they do that, then in the real world, they'll always do that, right? Because there's never going to be absolutely zero error rate. And it actually won't save them from doing the remaining steps that I'm going to talk about. Because, if Eve just decides to measure one bit, well, yeah, let me put off that discussion. Okay. In a little while, I'll tell you why they don't need to. So they'll have to say, what's some threshold error rate that we can tolerate? That threshold is determined by your security proof. Okay, so you're going to take the protocol as I'm presenting it, plus the remaining steps. And you have to prove that this thing is secure against anything that Eve does, assuming that Alice and Bob have their own private domains that Eve can't look in or modify. Provided the error rate is below some value, right? If the error rate is too high, well, they haven't really lost anything, right? They haven't given Eve any secrets, because all they've done so far is exchange random numbers using qubits, okay? But the idea is that the security proof tells you that if the error rate is below this value, whatever it may be, then with very high confidence, they know Eve has almost no information about the key that they're establishing. And that then they can safely use it, say, in the one-time pad or somewhere else, and have the desired level of security. Okay? It looks like I didn't write down in my notes what the actual threshold is. I think the best protocols known have something like about a 20% bit error rate for BB84, So if they see an error rate below 20%, they can do some post-processing, albeit maybe very inefficient, to keep some key. Whereas if it's above that, they should throw it out. It gives you an idea kind of what the right level is. 10% would be, you know, more comfortable.
How do you transport quantum information long distances for this?
Yeah, well, I'll get back to that at the end. But the easiest way, just think about Alice sends a photon to Bob, sends a stream of photons. And for instance, they can go through an optical fiber.
Oh.
OK. And you can do that over hundreds of kilometers. And people have done that and for this BB84.
Why not share a bunch of entangled bits and then use that for these?
You can do that, too. That's also good. OK. This is in some ways a bit easier than sending EPR pairs, because you don't have to create entangled photons. You just have to create single photons. There are some advantages to using entangled pairs. And people have done that too. There's a lot more that could be said about it. Why don't I finish this protocol, and then we'll see where we are, and we can discuss some of these other options. OK, so so this is where I ran out of space. So step six, then. So at this point, remember, Alice and Bob, they're down to maybe only one quarter of the original bits that they had. But they agree on them, and they're pretty confident that the error rate on those bits is reasonable, right? It's below whatever value cutoff they set. And so what do they do now? So now they want to correct the errors, because they want to get the same key bit string. So basically, they're going to do something that's pretty much a classical error correcting code. So they calculate the parities of their bits. Here, maybe I should say at this point that they discard the ones of the that they announced. So the ones that are left after this, they calculate the parities. That correspond to the parity checks of some classical code. So in this case, I'm assuming, in practice, Alice will send photons to Bob, and not all of them will get there. And so the ones that don't get there, Bob says, I didn't get a photon, and they just don't use that at all. The ones that do get there, though, might have errors in them. So that's what we're trying to correct. We're correcting the fact that the bits that they have at this point might not all be the same.
But because they randomly chose bases? It's like
right. But again, the random choosing of basis.
And discarding the 50%.
Yeah, they're discarding those. Just so anything that we've discarded here, we're just not using it. Okay, yeah. We're not trying to correct them. We're not trying to recover those that information.
Okay.
We're just trying to to correct for the disagreements that they might have in the one quarter of the bits that are left. So they announce the parities. And compare them to correct the errors. So for instance, if they measure the parity of five bits and those two parities disagree, then they know that one of them must have a bit flip in those sets of five. Really, they know there have to be an odd number of bit flips in between, okay? And so then they can, by clicking, picking appropriate set of parity checks that corresponds to a classical error correcting code, they can identify exactly where the bit flips are and then correct them. But notice that they've announced more information about their bit strings, right? So they should get rid of that. So they'll have to discard one bit per parity check announced. And this exactly compensates for the information that announced, right? So if they said the parity of bits 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is 0, and then they discard the first bit, well, the parity of bits 2, 3, 4, 5 could be equally likely to be 0 or 1, right? Depending on whether the first bit was 0 or 1. And so by doing this, they've compensated completely. And then they'll still have some left over because this is an error correcting. Basically, this is kind of the error correcting code encodes k bits in n bits, and that means it has n minus k parity checks. And so they've gone back basically to the k logical bits of this classical error correcting code. Okay. But they're not done at this point, okay? They've corrected the errors. They have keys that are the same, but they know the error rate is not too high or wasn't too high, so Eve could not have done too much eavesdropping. But they still don't know that Eve has no information about the key. Why is that? Well, certainly because they've allowed some error rate that would allow Eve to do some eavesdropping, right? But even if, like I said, in this step, suppose they had said, no, the error rate has to be 0. But even then, it still could be the case that Eve decided, well, you know, I'll just measure 1 or 2 qubits and do this, right? And if you got lucky, well, first of all, she could have gotten lucky and measured in the right basis, and then she'd actually know what it was and not create any errors. Or she could have gotten lucky, less lucky, measured in the wrong basis for one of them, but it didn't show up in this random subset that they were trying to use to identify the errors, right? And so there is a kind of a reasonable chance that Eve could have a small number of bits of information, or even a modest number, depending on this error rate, about what the key is that they have at this point. And so they have to do something called privacy amplification. So in particular, they again choose random parities. So they choose random subsets of the remaining bits and take the parity. Of each subset. So they keep these parities secret. So they're publicly choosing the subsets, but they're not announcing the values of the parities. And in fact, the parities are their final key. And then anything that's left over is discarded. Okay. So how does this get rid of the information that Eve might have? Well, suppose that they say, okay, the first key bit is going to be the parity of bits 2, 3, 6, and 8. And Eve has learned some information, right? So maybe she knows bits 2 and 3. But she doesn't know bits 6 and 8. In fact, even if she knows 3 of those 4 bits, or if she knows 2, 3, and 6, Well, the parity of all four is still, for her, random. Because if it, whether 8 is 0 or 1 flips the parity of the set of 4. Okay? So unless Eve manages to learn exactly all the bits in the in one of these subsets, she's not going to know any of these key bits. Okay? And more generally, if you want to treat it in kind of the arbitrary way, the amount of information she has about the key becomes exponentially small. Exponential in basically the number of bits that you're discarding at the end here. Because you're using fewer parities. So if you took parities of everything, right, and if you took as many parities as you had bits, then that would just be a linear transformation of the bits, and it would have, you could just go backwards, right? So it'd be equivalent. But when you take fewer parities than you have bits to start with, then you're kind of squeezing out some information that Eve has. And so it's going to be exponentially small in the number of bits that you're getting rid of. Okay? So the upshot is that Eve has a choice. She can either make an attack that is almost certain to be caught with probability exponentially close to 1 in terms of, you know, some of the parameters, well, basically in terms of big N, using what I've said here. Or she can do an attack that will probably not get caught or has a reasonable chance of not getting caught. But in that case, the amount of information she has about the key is exponentially small. Okay, and so Alice and Bob, they can use this QKD protocol. They run it. If they see too much errors, they abort and say, okay, it didn't work. Well, I'm gonna have to try again some other time. Hopefully, there won't be an eavesdropper then. And if it doesn't abort, then they can be confident that the key that they're using is secure, and then they can use that to actually encrypt the message. Okay? So any questions on the protocol?
So does this protocol actually, does the quantumness give you some kind of advantage?
Yeah. So the quantumness is coming in here. It's coming in here, right? So when Alice sends qubits to Bob, then if Eve measures, she actually introduces disturbance. Where if it's a classical bit, then Eve could measure and not introduce any disturbance.
What I mean to say is that there are classical protocols that also give you like an exponential chance of communication success, right? So why is this?
Well, okay, it depends what you're looking for, right? So classically, there's obviously, So there are some classical protocols that do something like this, but you have to put in some additional assumption. And the assumption tends to be, so for instance, there's protocols that say that suppose the channels being used between Alice and Bob has some kind of fundamental, irreducible noise in it that even Eve experiences. Okay? In that case, when Eve makes her measurements, even of classical bits, they're not going to be perfect. There's going to be some errors. She's not introducing noise here, but it means that she doesn't have perfect information about what Alice and Bob sent. And then they can use privacy amplification to get rid of that, of the information that she does get. In principle. Or there's some other protocols that assume that you have some big source of random numbers, and it produces so many random numbers that Eve can't possibly store them all. Okay. The problem with these things is that they're making assumptions that are maybe not very well validated, right? I mean, nowadays, you know, you can store huge amounts of data. And generating random numbers at that rate would be hard. So in QKD, sure, there's in practice, there is going to be noise in this channel between Alice and Bob. But we don't know that Eve is not just sitting right next to Alice, right outside her lab, and collecting everything that she sends, and then using her own error correcting code to send it on to something else that's here, and continuing on to Bob. So it could be that all the errors that we see in this channel are due to Eve. Right? That's what we have to assume in QKD. And so that's what you're getting away from. You're getting away from the need to make some assumption. You know, classical private key cryptography that's based on computational security makes a different assumption, right? Now you don't worry about distributing these keys. It's just a small key. You can use it many times. So you get it somehow. But then you have to assume that Eve has a bound on the computation she can do, right? And you have to assume that you're right, that this is actually a hard computational problem. Okay, stuff like that. So QKD lets you relax those kinds of assumptions. Now, there's still a bunch of other assumptions that come in, which is mostly kind of in the realm of assuming that this protocol is actually close enough to the real one that you're implementing. And so you'll explore one sort of thing that can go wrong in the tutorial tomorrow. Let me mention another thing that is really a matter of specifying the protocol correctly. And so this is an attack that Eve could do if you're not careful in how you implement things. So this is called a man-in-the-middle attack. So in this attack, what's going to happen is Alice is going to send qubits, and Eve is going to intercept them. And then, so this is quantum here. And then Eve is going to pretend to be Bob. And she's going to run this classical protocol, the classical post-processing, with Alice, just as if she were Bob. Okay? And then Alice and Bob will end up by establishing some secret key K1. And meanwhile, Eve is going to run her own QKD protocol, pretending to be Alice, by sending messages to Bob and then talking with him. Okay, so she'll send qubits to Bob. They'll talk back and forth. Eve and Bob will establish the key K2. Okay, and then Alice will think everything is fine. Bob will think everything is fine. So Alice will send a message. Encrypted with the key K1, and then Eve intercepts it, and she can decrypt it because she knows K1, and then she has to re-encrypt it if she really wants to not be caught with the key K2 and sends it to Bob. Okay, and so, neither Alice nor Bob ever had a chance to realize something was wrong. Everything looks to them just exactly like it should, right? Alice sent some qubits, she got some classical messages back and forth, they established some key, the error rate wasn't too high, so she sent her message off. And Bob, he received some qubits, had a conversation with the person on the other side, the error rate wasn't too high. And then he received an encrypted message. He was able to read it, and it made some sense, right? Because it actually was the message that Alice sent. But in between, Eve actually read it. Okay, so this attack then completely breaks the protocol. So how do you deal with this? Well, the key is here. Okay, if Eve is not able to masquerade as Bob or as Alice, then she can't pull this off, right? So if Alice sends these qubits to Eve, and Eve comes back and pretends to be Bob, but Alice can detect that she's lying, then it won't work. And so in particular, what you need here is not just any old classical public channel, but you need an authenticated channel. So it's a channel that, for instance, that Eve can read but not change. Okay, so she can see what the messages are that Alice and Bob are exchanging, but she can't alter them, and she can't pretend to be Bob by making her own messages. Okay, so one way to do this is using some initially shared private key. But luckily, the amount of private key you need to do that is quite small. And so using just a little bit of private key, Alice and Bob can then create these authenticated classical channels and then run QKD and generate a lot more private key. Okay, so in that context, what this quantum key distribution is doing is not creating your initial private key, but it's growing your private key. And this is something you really can't do classically, at least not modulo some of these other weird assumptions. Certainly, you can't do it in a computational secure way because, you know, if the first thing gets, the first protocol gets broken, then everything else is broken too. So you can't kind of magnify your security at all. Right. So it's maybe worth saying that this is also in some ways kind of similar to what happens with public key cryptography, right? Because in public key cryptography, Alice or Bob, say, has a public key that he wants to distribute to a bunch of people. But public key cryptography is not immune from a man-in-the-middle attack, right? Because Eve could send out a public key to Alice and say, this is Bob's public key. But it's not, actually. It's Eve's public key. And so if Alice tries to encrypt a message to Bob, Eve intercepts it, reads it, and then encrypts using Bob's public key. And in fact, if you're on the web and you ever go to some website and your browser says, alert, this certificate is not correct, what it's warning you about is the possibility that something like this has happened. So what we do in classical public key cryptography is people send out their public don't really send out their public keys by posting them publicly. They get some third party called a certificate authority to digitally sign, using another cryptographic protocol, their key to saying, this actually is this person's public key. I checked that. Okay? And then later on, you can send that to somebody else. And if you trust the certificate authority to really be checking, then you know it's a valid public key. But if you get a public key that's not signed by the certificate authority, or it doesn't correspond to that person, or something like that, then you might be suspicious. Now, a lot of the time when you see this, it's because your browser is out of date, or the certificate authority that they're using is something weird that you don't have, or something like that. But it could be that there's actually somebody intercepting and trying to do this man-in-the-middle attack with classical public key cryptography. So basically, what classical public key cryptography does is pretty similar to what quantum key distribution does, right? It turns an authenticated public channel, where you have something where you can announce but not change, announce and read but not change, into a private channel that you can encrypt between Alice and Bob. Okay? Okay, so now let me get back to some of these issues about how you actually implement this some related questions, other kinds of protocols. So certainly the easiest way, this is really only interesting from a practical point of view when Alice and Bob are not in the same place, right? If they're right next to each other, then establishing a secret key is very easy. They just, here it is. Okay. So if they're far apart, how do you send qubits from one place to the other? Well, certainly the easiest way to do that is to send photons. And as far as I know, pretty much every experiment that's done QKD used photons. There might be one or two somewhere that didn't, but certainly that's the dominant one. And photons, it's easy to go from one place to another. You either send them over an optical fiber, or you just send them through space. And people have done both through open air. But the problem is that in either case, there's going to be loss, right? The optical fibers can transmit for a while, but every so often a photon will get absorbed or reflected off in the wrong direction. Similarly, the air, it will get absorbed by something. And of course, there's other errors too, but loss is kind of the dominant issue. Now, loss is not inherently a problem, right? If Bob doesn't receive a photon, then they just don't use that bit in the protocol. But if the loss gets too high, then it does start to create a security issue, mostly by conjunction with some other imperfections in the protocol. And that's something that you'll explore in the tutorial, I think. So for instance, for optical fibers, the limit is a few hundred kilometers, 200, 300 kilometers. And really, over 100 kilometers, the rate of qi that you're getting out is pretty low. And moreover, you need to use some special tricks beyond what I've said in order to make it secure at that range. So that's fine if you just want to communicate with somebody that's in the same city as you. But if you want to communicate, you know, Toronto to Washington, DC, that's too far. And so you have to look at ways to extend your range beyond that. So one approach is to have a network of trusted substations, intermediaries, that you can use to establish qi. So an example that people usually give is, suppose you're a bank, right? You have, you're running a bank. You have a lot of bank branches, right? And, you know, there's a couple in the same city. The next one is maybe 100 kilometers away in the next city. That's okay. That's within range, right? So if each of your bank branches, they form some graph, and if you want to go from this branch to this branch, well, you establish qi, you know, everywhere along the way, and then, you know, you can send your secret messages in hops. And assuming that all of these bank branches actually are trustworthy, the message is still going to be secure. An eavesdropper cannot attack somewhere in here and learn anything, right? Because this link is secure by QKD. Now, one problem with this is that there are single points of failure, right? So if the eavesdropper breaks in to this bank's computer, or there's somebody in that bank that, you know, wants to make some extra money on the side, then your message is no longer secure, right? Because it gets to this point, and then somebody reads it, and then it continues on its way. Now you can kind of ameliorate this problem if you have multiple possible paths like this, because you can kind of you create one qi this way and one qi this way, and then take the XOR between them, and that way Eve has to attack two separate places in order to actually learn something. But it's kind of a step away from the ideal security guarantee that you're trying to get out of QKD.
So schematically, you're like repeating the. What are you doing?
Yeah. So each of these nodes, you're doing a separate QKD protocol, and establishing a separate secret qi, and then, well, for instance, you could just send the message along these hops, or you could send a random string and use that to create a qi between here and here, something like that. There's a variety of solutions. Okay. So another kind of related approach people have used is to use a satellite. So it turns out that a satellite in low Earth orbit is close enough that you can actually do QKD from the ground to the satellite by just sending the photons through the air. And China has a quantum satellite that's actually done this. Okay, so it's actually doable. So this is not just a theory. So at one level, of course, this lets you communicate with your satellite securely. So if you want to control it without having somebody, you know, manipulate your messages, that's fine. The other thing you can do is satellite is orbiting the Earth. So if you trust that the satellite is secure, you don't have all of these other things in between. You just have one thing in between. And the satellite, you know, Alice is down here. She establishes the qi up to the satellite. satellite goes around, you know, halfway around the planet and communicates with Bob, who does his own QKD protocol with it. And now Alice and Bob can share a secret key intermediated by that satellite. Okay? So an even better approach, you still have to trust the satellite there. But if the satellite creates EPR pairs and sends half to Alice and the other half to Bob, then you don't have to trust the satellite anymore. Okay? If it creates a lousy EPR pair, well, then you'll get a high error rate. If it creates a good EPR pair, then you'll be able to run a protocol.
Can you create EPR pairs, send some to someone, store the other ones, and then send them?
Well, that's harder. Okay. Yeah, it's much easier to, particularly with photons, right, to create them and then send them both at once. But nevertheless, you can still get a much longer range because the satellite, as we apply it, has a bigger kind of field of view than you would on the ground.
Can you just use entanglement harvesting to instantly create EPR pairs between two people?
You mean out of the vacuum?
Yeah.
In principle, in practice, the amount of entanglement in the vacuum is minuscule, and I'm not. Yeah, I actually don't know what the answer is for distillable entanglement. So you have to be able to do a protocol called entanglement distillation, which actually I'm going to mention in a minute. But because the entanglement in the vacuum is not directly usable, so you have to process it some. And the amount of usable entanglement you get decreases exponentially with distance. So it's very, very small on any kind of reasonable distance. And it may actually go to zero at some point. I'm not sure about that. There's still entanglement there. It's just, you know, there's too much other stuff. Because it's not just entangled with you. It's entangled with over there and over there and over there.
Wait, if the satellite's sending EPR pairs, do you still have to trust the satellite to not just send, like, one to both?
Right. So suppose the satellite, well, okay, so the homework problem is going to talk about EPR QKD. So I don't want to say too much. But suppose the satellite does send 1-1. Okay? Well, then Alice is still choosing a random basis to measure in. So if she happens to measure in the Z basis and Bob measures in the Z basis, then yeah, it'll look like 1-1, that'll be fine. But if Alice measures in the X basis, and Bob measures in the X basis, then now they're getting random stuff, which is really just the same as if Eve had measured.
Okay. Wait, sorry,
Okay. So let me just finish with the last solution, which is the idea of a quantum repeater. So first of all, this business about loss in optical fibers, that's obviously a big issue for classical communication as well, right? If you're sending classical messages over optical fibers, it's not great if you have, you know, a total loss of signal after a few hundred kilometers. So classically, what do? Well, they use an amplifier, a repeater. But what the amplifier basically does is it measures the light that's coming in and says, okay, this is the message. Let me send more light with that message. But that would not work with QKD, obviously, because measuring it is like an eavesdropper. Basically, this amplifier would be an eavesdropper. But suppose you use a quantum error correcting code that's configured to correct for loss of photons, erasure errors. Well, then it would work, right? Your quantum error correcting code will identify which qubits have been lost, but it won't learn anything about the message, right? That was the whole point, was to preserve superpositions. And so your repeater station, you don't even have to trust it, right? Because either it does the error correction well, in which case Bob is going to receive the qubit that Alice sent, unchanged and unmeasured, or it does it badly, in which case the error rate will be high and you'll abort the protocol. Okay. And so what you'd want to do is you'd want to establish a similar network of repeater stations around so that, you know, you can send whatever you want from, say, from here to here, through these repeater stations, each of which does quantum error correction. So actually, it turns out better not to do error correction per se, but to do entanglement distillation. So what is entanglement distillation? Well, the very simple case that we have here, what we're going to do is we're going to establish EPR pairs along each of these links. Okay, and so each of these links, remember, is within, you know, some reasonable amount of loss. And then the repeaters, well, so this repeater station and this repeater station, say this one sends half of the EPR parrot to this one. And this one says, okay, I got the first one. I didn't get the second, third, fourth, and fifth. I got the sixth one. So let's keep the first one and the sixth one, okay? And that's an advantage over quantum error correction. In quantum error correction, Alice has to send these qubits to Bob without knowing which ones get lost. In the entanglement distillation, Bob can talk back to Alice and give her information about what happened. And so they only have to keep the EPR pairs that got through. And then once they've done that, they can, you know, knit them all together using entanglement swapping and then have an EPR pair shared between here and here.
So that's basically teleportation, right?
Yeah, that's basically teleportation.
Teleportation can be an advantage.
Yeah, yeah. Okay? So entanglement distillation is very closely related to quantum error correction, but usually you distinguish between one-way entanglement distillation where Alice only sends information to Bob, and then it's basically the same thing as error correction, or two-way, where Bob can talk back, and then it can be more efficient.
Is that not precisely the same as transporting the qubit via teleportation?
Well, yeah, I mean, so once you establish an EPR pair between Alice and Bob, yeah, you could teleport, but you don't actually need to because you can directly measure the EPR pair. This is what you'll do in the homework. But if you want, you can just think of it as teleporting. It works the same way. Okay? Any other questions? Okay. So then for the rest of the week, we'll talk about some kind of more information theoretic side of quantum computing, usually called quantum information theory. Talk about entropies and stuff like that.
Oh, so are there equivalents to like Shannon's source coding theorem and notation?
Yeah. I'll mention these.
Like a quantum version of these.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, well, this is what that's one of the main things we'll be talking about in the next few days.
So is there a lot of money being poured into doing this technology? I imagine?
Quantum key distribution. I mean, actually, right now, there's more money being poured into quantum computing, per se. Quantum key distribution is a lot easier than quantum computing. And people have been doing it experimentally for a long time. There have been commercial QKD products for, at this point, certainly more than 10 years. The repeaters have been hard because you have to interface between kind of quantum computing technologies that do error correction or entanglement distillation, or for that matter, store, even just storing information, and the light. And that's been slower. I mean, it was not obvious 20 years ago that was the case, but the quantum computing has proceeded much faster than the repeaters, even though they're kind of related technologies. Okay, so see you tomorrow.